Are we starting with chapter 3, or we got to do a little bit of chapter 2?
Theodora is asking about chapter 3, gospel, love, and humanistic altruism. Right. We may or may not get to that in chapter 3, because I keep taking two steps forward and one step back. And I'm thinking of doing the same thing again this week. And what I've done when I've done that, taken that one step back, I picked up different things than we picked up the first time we went through. And I think I kind of like to do that a little bit again quickly and then come up to where we left off last time, which I believe is page 25.
Yep.
Okay, so yes, I want to backtrack very quickly just to 21 for a little bit of review. Okay, now, Archbishop Averke has said something that we're probably all familiar with, and that is that a person is tripartite, body, soul, and spirit. And he's talked a bit about the body and how the body more or less is interested in taking care of itself, and all of its concerns have to do with its welfare. And at that level, that makes perfectly good sense. Otherwise, how would physical animals survive? And when we are mainly concerned about the body, he has pointed out to us that we are actually very little different from animals, because at that level we share an awful lot with animals. The things that make us different are not the things about our bodies. The things that make us different are not even just completely our soul, because as he mentions, the soul is primarily, again, like the body, concerned about its own taking care of itself, and it is primarily concerned about ordering this world and making sure that everything is, at the bottom of page 20, the activity of the soul is directed toward the fulfillment of the demands of temporal life. So the idea that the soul is somehow built in to be higher, oriented toward higher spiritual things, we used another word there, and that's spirit. So the soul could be entirely world-oriented. For the soul to be oriented toward something higher, that depends on the activity of the spirit, and the spirit is from God, unless, of course, the spirit has become more like the soul and involved more with the soul's concern with this world and the body's concern with this world, and then there's a worldly spirit. But the human spirit is meant to be the dynamic means of ascent and orientation of the soul toward God. Third of the way down on page 21, the life of the body consists of satisfying the needs of the body. In the life of his body, a human does not in any way differ from other living animals. In fact, the Latin word anima basically translates into what we would recognize as machine, a mechanism, something that automatically seeks what it needs for itself. Now, when we think of machine, we think of something made out of metal. But essentially, that's what animal means. So it's machine-like. Interesting. And this next pages 22 and 23, I think, are very difficult. And if we think they're not, we probably didn't understand them, it seems to me. And I want to focus on something in particular. I'm going to reconstruct a sentence there at the end of the first paragraph in order to make it more direct. The soul uses the brain for mental labor. The brain is the organ of the body that the soul uses for mental labor. The soul uses the brain for mental labor. Now, why do I think that's important? Because we're talking about a project that the soul engages in order to organize things to strengthen its way of being organized in the world for its own sake, generally in a world-oriented way. So it's just a logical procedure. The soul uses the brain for that purpose. Why do I think that's important? I think it's important because we're talking about the soul engaging in a kind of project and using the brain to accomplish the mental labor to fulfill the project. That's the way he's thinking about the relationship between soul and what's going on in the mind. Okay, that's one thing. The next thing I think is more difficult, and it has to do with the heart. The way he says it is this: the organ of feeling is usually referred to as the human heart. This is because all emotions, joy or grief, sorrow or pleasure, likes or dislikes, anger or a peaceful disposition of spirit, calm or agitation, always resound in the heart, either by adding energy or slowing down its activity. First, I want to pick up on something that he has said here when he says, either by adding energy or slowing down. That's something the heart does. You need to accomplish something, your heart beats faster. It speeds up, it gives you more energy. You slack off, when you relax and you become more peaceful, your heart slows down. So the heart can speed up and slow down. And that's a capacity that the human, physical, biological heart has, that he is saying the heart, in this not biological way of thinking of the heart, but the heart as a place where things happen. And our heart, our physical heart, is a place where things happen. Strictly biological level. Blood comes in, blood goes out. There's oxygen involved that's going into the blood. So there's a combining going on there. Well, that imagery of the heart directly applies to what we mean when we talk about the place of the heart. And here is the key to getting unconfused about the difference between the way Archbishop Averke is talking and the way you may have heard the heart spoken of in other cases. The key to getting not confused is to remember that the heart is a place. Human being is tripartite, body, soul, and spirit. Where is the heart? Well, the heart is not one of those. The heart is a place that is both physical, somatic, it is also psyche. Psyche means soul, so the soul is involved, the body is involved, and the spirit is involved. Body, soul, and spirit are all involved, and things that have to do with them occur in the heart, because the heart is a place, not a part. Okay, so I think that's helpful. And I think here's the way to sort out some confusion that may come. If you remember Bishop Callisto's description of the heart and other people's descriptions of the heart, part of this, I think, is teaching, strategy of teaching that has developed in the last 30 or 35 years. A way of talking about the heart has become kind of standard, and it fits perfectly. It's not something made up. It fits perfectly and perfectly presents the teachings of the fathers. And what I have in mind is this: if you've heard Bishop Callisto's recordings on this or other people's, you'll find him making a strong distinction between, and he uses the example of a quotation from some duchess who's writing a passionate novel, partly autobiographical, and she uses the expression, "The heart has reasons that the mind knows not of." And what does she mean? She means romantic, passionate feelings. That's what we have in our heart. Our heart is the place of our emotions, our feelings, and we need to trust our heart. And I'm not advising this. This is not advice from an Orthodox priest. This is the assumptions of a society that is devoted to the idea that trusting your emotions and your feelings is the deepest kind of wisdom, and that you should be true to the deepest emotional and passionate wisdom of your heart in an emotional sense, and people consider that spiritual. Now, Archbishop Averke would say, this person is all confused. They have confused the body and the soul, and they've made a kind of spirituality that has more to do with the body and the soul oriented toward this world than anything else. And this is not real spirituality. This is confusion. And so what Bishop Callistos does is he says, when we are talking about the heart, we are not talking about the heart as the seat of the passions, a kind of reservoir that holds the passions. And if you want to know what you really feel, or sometimes people even say, what we really think, and we actually mean feel, what do I really feel, what really moves me, then you resort to consulting this reservoir, the seat of the passions. That's obviously not what we mean. And then he talks about how the heart is a vast place where a lot of things can happen. And there are valleys and there are mountains and dragons lurk there and other forces. And what is he saying when he's saying all of that and using all that imagery? Essentially what he's saying boils down to saying the heart is a place where things happen, things of a spiritual nature that have to do with the body, the soul, and the spirit. Those things happen there. And what happens there and how you are oriented or disoriented or controlled by passions and desires or becoming free from passions and desires and reaching out beyond that, whatever is going on there, what comes out of your mouth is because of what's going on there in your heart. That's the way he wants to talk about the heart. Now, the question is there any contradiction between what Bishop Callistos does when he makes that strong distinction between the heart as a reservoir, the place of the seat of the passions, and what Bishop Verkey has just said? I would say no, and I think you could read what we just read and say, Bishop Verkey is saying that the organ of feeling is the human heart. It sounds an awfully lot like what Bishop Callistos is warning us against. But the key to not being confused, I think, is this. All emotion resounds in the heart. All emotion resounds in the heart. So emotion is something that goes on in the heart. It becomes involved with the bodily passions. It becomes involved with the passions of the soul and the desires of the soul. Anything that is emotional, if it's emotional in a positive sense or in a negative sense, if it is an emotion of lust, it's there. If it is an emotion of a passionate love of God and all that is divine and holy and perfect and beautiful in a spiritual way, that is an emotion, and it will be involved there. So any kind of emotion, positive or negative, will echo, resound in the heart. It's a very different way of talking about the heart than reducing the heart to the seat of the passions, a reservoir of passions. And I think that's the key to not becoming confused. Now, of course, the danger is that I may have confused everybody by trying to be so clear. But there is a possibility of becoming confused and reading this and saying, aha, all those other people that said all those things that were so confusing to me, I can forget about them. Because here Bishop Verkey is agreeing with basically secular and non-orthodox way of understanding the heart as the seat of emotions. Because the organ of feeling is usually referred to as the human heart. This is because all emotions, and then by that time we're already locked into accepting that he is affirming this non-orthodox understanding of the heart, and he isn't. Okay, that's what I want to. That's what I want to be clear about.
He does say it's the place.
Absolutely, of course. Yes, he does say it's the place. Thank you. That's important. That's important. I think that's very important.
Yeah, the heart becomes the center of our life.
Yes.
The place where all that enters from outside is contained, and out of which comes all that which is within.
Now, a secular, non-orthodox person could say, you see, the place that is most important is my emotions, my passions, my feelings. That's not what he's saying. Why does it become important? It's because it's where everything goes on. It's Grand Central Station, body, soul, and spirit. Everything goes through there. Our relationship to God is through the heart. Our relationship to the world, as far as our spiritual orientation toward God and how we deal with the world, that is all worked out in the heart. Mary pondered these things in her heart. You see, there's pondering going on there. You know, there's prayer going on in there. There's the descent of the mind. If you have the descent of the mind into the heart, one way we could think about is that when the soul wants to use the brain for mental labor, that's one thing. It could be practically oriented. But if the mind, and remember, It could be spiritual intellect or practical intellect. If the soul is using the brain for mental labor, it is probably using it for practical labor to figure out how it can feather its own nest. You know, there we have another image, but it's related by way of British poetry. But anyway, if the mind, the spiritual intellect, the capacity to recognize the things that are holy and good and beautiful and true, descends into the heart, it's like putting a drop of something into that chaos that makes it go clear. It's the descent of the mind into the heart, and things can clarify and make more sense and fall into their right place. Prayer becomes possible because this spiritual intellect, this capacity, has become part of what is going on in Grand Central Station. That would be one way of pointing out the role the mind could play in the heart. Okay, now he's going to move on to something else. Now, let me ask people, does this make any sense? Does this,
oh yeah.
Okay, so we're not, there's no grading going on, no clashing of gears or anything like that. Okay. Now he moves on to the will. The will controls a person's desires. By way of our will, we choose whether our desires are going to be heavenward or whether they're going to be earthward. Our will acts through the parts of the body, and it also acts on the soul. The activity of our mind and feelings given birth by the heart has an effect on the will. So how things get sorted out in our heart will affect the will that we use to act in the world, by way of our body, by way of our passions and desires. Do we want to limit them or just let them fly? It's a choice, and this is where Father Deacon's question comes in.
What is the locus of the I, the decision maker of the man?
The will. If we're not determined, we choose. We have a will that is free to choose God or the world. We can do that. Okay. Now I'm happy. I wasn't happy before. I felt like there was too much floating around. I'm so happy that I'm happier to go to page 25, unless there's something else anybody would like to talk about. Okay, the proper hierarchy is for the body to consult the soul as to what to do and how to live, and for the soul to consult the spirit. Then we're moving in the right direction. Then we're free. You know, we're able to act freely. Our will be able to choose to encourage us to affirm the things that are good, because it will be more clear, because we're oriented properly. If we become disoriented, then the spirit turns to the soul to decide what to do, and the soul turns to the body, and everything is upside down. You know. And people, Bishop Evarchy would say, would call that a spirituality. But it's not the spiritual nature of man to be disoriented from God and be consulting the soul's concern for doing well in the world. There is a world-oriented spirituality, but it's not the true spirituality. Go ahead, Chair.
At the bottom of 23, he quotes from the spiritual life and how to attune,
right.
Be attuned to it. The spirit is, as a force, proceeding from God, knows God, seeks after God, and only in him finds its rest. By means of some kind of hidden spiritual sensitivity, the spirit is convinced of its origin in God. The spirit feels its total dependency on him and acknowledges that it is obliged to please God in every way and live in him and for him.
The problem is, did you want to say something else?
No, I just think that's a pretty good definition.
It is a good definition. The possible problem there is that we could say, well, if that's the way we all are, then there's no problem. But that isn't a description of how we necessarily are. It's a description of how things are supposed to work. It's a description, you could also say, of the nature of the spirit when the spirit is being what the spirit was created to be. The problem is that the spirit can become disoriented. And then it is, you could say, it no longer is the spirit created by God. That would be true, I think.
When the spirit becomes disoriented, it's that the expression of the spirit becomes disoriented.
Right.
Sure.
That sounds better.
That's fine. That's fine. The point that we need to be aware of is that we're dealing with something here that is dynamic. That is dynamic, and that it can be changeable. It's something in movement. It's not something that is fixed and is a certain way. The fall would not be possible. You know, if God had not given us freedom, you know, then, you know, there wouldn't have been a fall. So it is, but it is possible for us to choose. And the choosing always has to do with love. And what do we love God, or do we love the world and ourselves? Do we love God and others, or do we love ourselves and the world? The dynamic is about that, is about love. That's the way it works.
There was something you said that I'm a little confused about, though. This, I think the spirit directs the soul, but it seems to me that the will determines whether the soul turns to the body or to the spirit.
I don't know about that. It's not like we are in charge at the level of will, I don't think. People come to confession and they want to stop doing what they're doing, and then they say, I'm going to go and I'm going to do better. If it were so that we could rely on our own will and strength, the will is in charge, the will say, I have repented, I reoriented myself toward God. From now on, I am going to move in that direction. That isn't the way the will operates. The will only encourage us to do what needs to be done if we are spiritually upright or oriented toward God. Then the will guide the things that we do in the world. It will see the things that need to be done. If we're disoriented, we won't even see those things. I think it's more like that.
Okay.
So the role of the will is not commander-in-chief with all the power and authority to direct us. That vision of God is incorrect. God doesn't operate like that. And the will in a human being is not like that either, I don't think. If it were, we would just say, okay, from now on, hey, I'm going to be a saint. I've decided this is my will. I have free will. I will choose it. That would be autonomous. The will is not autonomous. It has to do with our relationship to God. The will has a more humble role, I think, to play than that.
The will is really just a function, a soul, which is what he said.
Where does he say that?
The psychology of the will. That's one of the functions of the soul.
Okay. Basically. It's kind of like when he said the soul uses the brain for mental labor.
And the psychology of feelings and the psychology of will, yeah. So, I mean, those are the different functions of the soul.
You could even say, I could be wrong, that the spirit uses the will to accomplish good in the world. It's good. Like engages the will, I would say, and the will becomes engaged by the spirit's movement toward God and the soul's love of God and descent, and the will becomes engaged, and now you're joyful as you go about doing the good things that you ought to do. Say we're disoriented spiritually, oriented toward the world and love of ourselves. The will can be perfectly content to busy itself about getting the soul's worldly way. But why is it like that? I mean, can the will choose to orient itself without love? Without repentance. Repentance is not simply a repentance of will, I don't think. It's got to be a positive love of God that is a spiritual love of God, where the soul is moved to ascend toward God in love. And then the will becomes involved. I think it's more like that.
Okay.
That's how I understand it. But remember, not on so much on the basis of personal, you know, like if we were listening to Elder Paisios and he said that, then we would know that he was saying it from experience, whereas I am saying it by way of analysis, which is not nearly as reliable. Okay. So spiritual life is about satisfying the needs of the spirit. What are the needs of the spirit? The spiritual life consists of satisfying the needs of the spirit, and the needs of the spirit consist of a person's striving toward God, seeking for living communion with Him, and the desire to live according to God's will. When we talk about spiritual life, striving toward God, seeking for a living communion with Him, and a desire to live according to God's will are not necessarily the thing that the average person in our society has in mind when they talk about spiritual life. So spiritual life here is very specific. It has to do with fulfilling ourselves as God created us to be. The needs of our spirit are to strive toward God, seek for communion with Him, to know God, and to live according to His will. Is this the way people today understand the spiritual life? Our times are characterized by all kinds of masquerading, masks, substitutions. He talks earlier about substitutions for spiritual life, substitutions for seeking God. Our times are characterized by masquerading, falsity, manipulation, perversity, and malicious distortions. This is the world of advertising and the fantasies on television that we occupy ourselves with. That's what they're all about. This is quite understandable. The flaunting spirit of self-validating pride is clearly unattractive if we actually look at it for what it is, just as its father Satan is clearly unattractive. Therefore, since this evil spirit of pride is unattractive, it's ugly and disgusting, it has to masquerade, hide itself behind various seemingly well-intended disguises. And so we have so-called spiritualities that have to do with the pursuit of self-validating pride. Title of the chapter is The Importance of Spiritual Discernment. We have to be able to discern spiritually between the true spirituality and these substitutions, where masquerade and malicious distortion are the order of the day. Okay. Page 26, he points out that the spirit, third part of a person, the part that comes from God, part that isn't just created, the body created and the soul created, the body and the soul like the animal, dealing with the consequences of the fall, basically trying to establish some kind of security. The third part, the spirit, is completely ignored by our contemporaries. They combine the spirit and the soul into one. Generally, when people talk about the soul, what they mean is what Bishop Averke is talking about in two terms. Soul and spirit. The soul could be completely about these worldly establishment of ourselves, but the spirit can't. It's from God. You can't just collapse it into the soul. If you've done that, you've disoriented the soul from God, and the spirit is somehow trying to feed on the worldly orientation of the soul, and it will starve. So it's always going to be hungry. It can never fulfill itself. We can never fulfill ourselves spiritually by way of this world. In contemporary psychology, the manifestations of the spirit are perceived to be, understood to be, part of the life of the soul. Religious feeling, moral feeling, and the conscience are considered to be part of the soul's function. Modern man frequently doesn't differentiate between the actions of the body, the soul, and spiritual life, mixing them up, creating total confusion. Now, the expression spiritual life, in quotation marks, can mean absolutely anything except that which is authentic spiritual life. What is emotional or natural is assumed to be spiritual, and that which relates exclusively to the secular is misunderstood to be spiritual life. Why has this taken place? Because of the self-confirming spirit of human pride, which has become the dominant spirit of our times. Remember the importance of masks. If this dominant spirit is self-confirming spirit of human pride, it is going to use masks to try to pretend that it is something else. Top of page 27. Authentic spiritual life, striving of the human spirit toward God, and a sincere desire to live according to the dictates of the conscience are absent in the majority of modern people. What a statement. The majority of modern people have no desire to live according to the conscience.
And no striving of the human spirit towards God.
And no striving toward God. Instead, there is a kind of rebellious pseudo-sophistication where the traditional understanding of moral values is ridiculed, and people pretend that they're above that. And if you're not, it's because you're just one of those fundamentalistic Christians. That what?
Fundamentalistic throwbacks.
Fundamentalistic throwbacks, behind the times. The spirit of self-asserting human pride strives to establish faith in itself in place of faith in God. The voice of the conscience unmasks deception. Last thing we want. This deters the freedom to act according to the dictates of the conscience and is suppressed and extinguished by pride. That's what's forbidden. First place is given to the soul, if this happens, and the rule of the mind, feelings, and will. And that's the content of life for the majority of people. This is why the Word of God calls such a person worldly. It's not just about being concerned about the physical things of the world. It's about the fact that your soul loves and desires these things and understands itself in terms of those things and does not want to have its pretenses unmasked. It doesn't want to have its self-confirming pride unmasked and revealed for what it is. It can pretend to be lots of other, much more acceptable things. What is spiritual is incomprehensible and foreign to such people, and therefore they cannot understand or accept what proceeds from the Spirit of God. However, even under this condition of suppression of the Spirit that God has given us, the needs of the Spirit will demand their rights. The need of the Spirit to strive toward God, the need of the Spirit to be in communion with God. You can't crush that completely. And so, the Spirit satisfies itself by substitutes. Substitutes are invented by the same human pride in order to make it calm. Anything from worldly life capable of fully captivating the person can be used as a substitution. I've moved over to 28. The substitute for spirituality by something emotional is a defining characteristic of our times. This even happens in the church. People can come to the liturgy and just love the beauty of the icons and the music and just really become emotionally enervated and energized by it in a way that is a substitute for what it's there for. Instead, they're fixed on that for itself and can even be used to build ourselves up emotionally, egotistically, without any awareness or attraction toward God. We can enjoy the Divine Liturgy as a beautiful and aesthetic experience, very moving to our desire for self-exaltation. And our participation in the Divine Liturgy, we might say, remains in the realm of worldliness and is foreign to genuine spirituality, quoting from the end of the second paragraph on page 28. Worldly, earthly feelings are so close to spiritual ones that it is difficult for a modern man to differentiate between them. He takes the emotional to mean spiritual, especially if you're a materialist. If it's not physical, it must be spiritual. All emotions, therefore, become spiritual. I feel it in my heart. I mean, you know, it's spiritual, right? That other sense of the term, the heart. Sometimes it seems to him that he receives total spiritual satisfaction from what is earthly. But he's only deceiving himself. He is deluded. That is not our nature, and that is not the nature of spiritual life. That's the nature of emotional self-gratification, using things that may be holy, abusing them to that purpose. Middle of the last paragraph on page 28. A genuine spiritual state is always totally passionless, not offering any worldly sensations. Every natural worldly state, no matter how elevated it may be, will without fail stimulate some worldly, fleshly, carnal, that's what carnal means, fleshly, sensation, a pleasurable scintillation of the nerves, goosebumps, maybe. Get your goosebumps from the Beatles, not from the Divine Liturgy.
And yeah, it can be very therapeutic from time to time.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the Greeks talk about it, emptying your, what do they call that?
Cathartic.
Cathartic, yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely cathartic.
Yeah, but anyway.
Get that out of your system before you come to church.
That's not a spiritual feeling.
No. Well, it's not, it has nothing to do with spirituality in the true sense.
Right.
It is a spirituality that is entirely involved with emotion, the soul, but assent to God? No. It's a pleasurable scintillation. But if that's what you're doing at the Divine Liturgy, yeah, that's a problem.
That's the confusion of the charismatic movement, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. And I think materialists make the best charismatics of all, because they need that desperately. Some kind of emotional. It's physical, it's emotional, it's very soulful. But when he starts to talk about love, and you realize that love, as Christians understand it, is either ascetic or it's not Christian love. If there's no participation in the cross of Christ and no ascent from a love of this world, then how could you call it Christian love? But our society is convinced that all of those other kinds of love are by definition Christian. And if you say they're not, well, then you're just a really horrible person, and we are. We are really horrible in that way.
So how did we get here?
Well, how did we get here? Oh, that's a different book. This book is about how to get out of it. It's a long, sad story, how we got here. But more easily told than accomplishing the escape.
Right.
Which is what we're about here. This overwhelming dominance of emotionalism in contemporary people explains why genuine, strict church singing, which satisfies only spirituality, instead of our fathers that bring to mind a slow and steady pan across the high school class, putting all of their emotion and feeling into their final song, and there are tears on the people's faces, and there are our fathers like that, and I've been threatened by one that it will be sung when I at my funeral, because I've forbidden it from the Divine Liturgy as long as I'm alive.
You won't have to hear it.
I won't have to hear it. So this is the kind of thing he's talking about.
You told them to sing it.
No, I told them they could not sing it until my funeral. Okay. That doesn't mean that it can happen then.
Oh, I interpret that.
Well, if I sit up and complain, then they'll be sorry. Church singing, which satisfies only spirituality, is bewildering and boring for the majority. They must have schmaltz, some choirs. Even for those considered to be church-going. They do not like it. We have replaced strict church singing of the past two centuries with Italian concert singing, which satisfies the worldly minded and is therefore favored by our contemporaries who wallow in emotionalism and in their opportunity to participate in said emotionalism right in the middle of the Divine Liturgy. So that happens. In other issues related to genuine spirituality, modern man is dim-witted and deaf. I can't hear it. What is wrong with it? It doesn't sound emotional to me. Does sound spiritual. While at the same time very sensitive to worldly things that he often takes to be spiritual. The spirit of modernity, the spirit of self-proclaimed pride, has made it a goal to exterminate the idea of God, or the experience of God, even more important, because we can always name God the love of myself, and put a mask in front of it, and then we all believe in God in America. We are the most God-believing nation on the face of the earth. And how is it that at the same time we love ourselves more than anything else? Because for us, God is a mask. And behind the mask, me, you, everybody else. We all believe in God.
And what do we believe about God?
Yeah. To exterminate the idea of God from the lives of people now, and to deify man as the God for modern times. The lifestyle of modern man is arranged in such a way that there is no place for genuine spiritual life. The very pulse of modern life is nervous, refusing to allow a person any solitude for self-examination. This is the ultimate purpose of the iPhone. To eliminate the possibility of self-examination.
The me phone, right?
What?
The me phone.
The me phone, yes, I. I mean, you think it's an accident? The iPhone, of course, that's what it is. Creating an atmosphere hostile to leading a spiritual life. Allowing no time for self-reflection, introspection, attention to the movements of one's spirit, and to the voice of one's conscience. This nervous, rabid lifestyle leaves no time to work on himself, for anyone, a necessary demand of the spiritual life, that we must work on ourselves. The only desire that remains is to be entertained, to relax, to get away for a time. Little by little, I'm jumping down to the bottom. Little by little, a person descends from the natural to gross carnality, becoming like a body without a soul. And I have one word encircled in the center of page 31, and that word says it all, and that word is depravity. Moral decay leading to animal-like behavior and self-destruction. The only salvation for mankind, a spiritual life, although not that spiritual life offered to moderns by their cultural guides who falsify and replace, quote, spirituality, unquote, with, quote, worldly thinking, unquote, but genuine spiritual life, which manifests itself in striving toward God, in searching to commune with him, and in the desire to live by his holy will. The importance of spiritual discernment. So, these are the things that we have to spiritually discern. Is this spiritual what we're going to devote ourselves to? Is it a mask that we've fallen in love with a mask, you know, for something else, for self-asserting pride? Great chapter. Okay. Anybody have difficulty with any of these? I don't mean understanding it. I mean in your own life. You had any difficulties of these kinds?
Maybe you should invert the question.
What's that?
Maybe you should invert the question. Is anybody not having difficulty? What I meant by my earlier question was, I mean, it would seem that the training of children is probably the penultimate necessity.
Yeah, but the thing is that we can only train them by being their parents.
Right.
I think, not by...
No. No. But generally speaking, I mean, if a person's not trained properly as they're growing up, then...
They have to have a mother or, hopefully, and a mother and a father who love them more than they love themselves. Otherwise, they will be training them to be like themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there's an irony here. And we could say, well, only saints should have children. Well...
Only saints aren't interested children. In having children.
Saints may not want to, you know, I don't know. Or another problem with that is that for most of us, children have something to do with becoming more saintly than we are to begin with. Because we started out as children, and people would say, well, I don't think I'm ready to have children. I think I'm not mature enough, and so you will never have children. This came up, Ricky's daughter-in-law, is that, or son-in-law, and which one? No, his daughter-in-law is the pregnant one.
Yeah.
And
son-in-law, isn't it?
No, not the son-in-law. But I didn't know if it was his daughter or his daughter-in-law.
It's his daughter-in-law.
Daughter-in-law, right. And she's going to have a baby, and of course, and you know, it's right for us when we're about to be parents to be concerned that we're not ready. Because what else is going to point out to us that we definitely aren't, you know? And I just said, well, again, it's something you can only learn by doing it. you know. Well, all spiritual life is like that. And you can't start anywhere other than where you are, so you don't have to worry about that part.
That's the woeful part.
But yeah, we have to be more concerned about them than ourselves, which, even if that concern is there, we can't just figure, well, that's enough. They're going to be okay once they go out on their own because they're just as free as we were. You know, it's always disappointing to us to see our children go out and do all the same dumb things we did when we did everything we could to kind of steer them in another direction. And of course, and our parents did too, you know, to the best of their ability.
I know, I remember my mother bemoaning the fact that
we were doing the same dumb things that she did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, our kids probably have missed a few things that we did.
God willing.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, the times are different.
Some of them have, and then we probably don't know as much about
them. Oh, yes, that's a blessing.
So how many of them?
Our parents didn't know what we did either.
Adopt the church and just run with it straight, leaving the whole thing.
What's that?
How many of the offspring?
Oh.
Grow up, adopt the church, and just run with it?
40%, I understand.
Are you serious? Is that high?
Maybe. Well, they say 60% leave. So one would presume that means 40% don't. What's left of 40%?
That, I mean without major deviations for a while.
Yeah. And, well, you don't know who's coming back in the end.
Oh, sure. It was definitely well ingrained in the early years.
Yeah. Well, who?
Well, you know, if a child's growing up in the Orthodox Church, and
yeah,
I mean, it's pretty well ingrained. I have to tell you,
I'm only 68, so the jury is out on that. As far as our kids are concerned, we're not old enough, and we may not get old enough to find out what's going to happen in the end. It is very disappointing because I know in my spiritual struggle, in my 20s or late 20s. One of my concerns was the spiritual heritage that I could pass on to my children. Maybe I just gave them something specific to rebel against, which I think is a difficulty in our society.
Possible.
You know, there's not a lot left to rebel against.
I mean, it's all been rebelled.
It's all been used. You know, I mean, what hasn't been rejected by now? There's pitifully little left.
Including the Confederate flag.
Oh,
still
you know, it's all been done. It's all been done.
Yeah.
So if you become Orthodox and raise your kids in the Orthodox Church, they've got a chance to rebel against something significant.
They have. They have helpers. So I watched a young man who had been in the church and gone out. And then he saw a photograph of himself in his more youthful years, and he did quite a double take. Because he had fallen, you know, noticeably away from that level of grace that he was enjoying in his younger years.
Well, that's probably the case with a lot of us converts. The honeymoon days in the beginning, when God was being gentle with us, and the choices were obvious, it doesn't stay like that. More and more is expected of us. It's good to have a good memory.
That's cool.
You know, I mean, what if you forgot what it was like at the beginning? That would be bad. I mean, we talk about the sins of our youth, but there's the grace of our youth, too, at least for our converts.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many things that happened to me in the beginning that I had no idea what they were. Now I have the temerity to suspect what they may have been, at least, although I am very careful about coming to conclusions about that sort of thing. I can't believe how ready people are to declare things divine
intervention
on my behalf personally. I mean, Father Schmemann assured us that there was no such thing as individual eschatology. My destiny. What is God's plan for me? As opposed to everybody else. And the fact of the matter is that God's plan is the same for all of us. He wants us to become like Him. And whatever it takes for us to deal with whatever husk of a human being we find ourselves to be, mm-hmm. That's His plan. It's not some kind of an individual. Well, like, you know, they used to say about the quest for the historical Jesus and Albert Schweitzer, who was a good man, you know, and did a lot of good. Oh, pretty arrogant too, but you know, when he wrote his book, Quest for the Historical Jesus, and other people wrote their books trying to discover what is the face of Christ, they all ended up describing him as their face. He's just like me, only he's divine. You know, and that's what happens. So we don't have a Christ with my face kind of destiny. And people always want to know, well, I wonder what God wants me to do this week. I wonder, God, I think God has encouraged me to do this, or God told me to do. What is wrong with these people? God wants you to be like him, you know, like Christ. And it's always ascetic, and it always amounts to leaving behind all of that self-affirming narcissism, that self-asserting pride, which is the spirituality, this content of the spirituality of who knows, maybe the majority of the so-called Christians in this country. I mean, if we're going to call a spade and not be confused about the nature of Orthodox Christian spirituality, genuine spirituality, we have to confront the fact that for the most part, we have made up a type of supposedly Christian spirituality that focuses on fulfilling a likeness of Christ that looks like me. My destiny, my eschatology, my ultimate fulfillment. And that's not Christianity.